You should not exist. Neither should your family, or your neighbors, or the person who served you in the supermarket earlier today. The world should not exist. There shouldn't be any great art or music. There shouldn't be hunger or the horrors of war. There shouldn't be any of it. There shouldn't even be a universe. Let's begin at the beginning, at the Big Bang. An implausible and unlikely event, a 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 123 chance. 10 to the 10 to the 123 is sometimes called the Penrose number, named after the Nobel Prize-winning British physicist and mathematician Sir Roger Penrose. It measures the remarkable level of order and precision with which our universe was created. Order and precision are known to decay over time. You see it with the wires that lead into an old pair of headphones, getting more and more tangled as time goes by. You see it in the crumbling ruins of an ancient city, magnificent buildings carved thousands of years ago by our ancestors, reduced to dust and rubble by the passage of time. Penrose knew that our universe should behave in the same way, its order and precision decaying over time, just like the cities of ancient Egypt, China, and Mesoamerica. He knew that black holes were the crumbling ruins of the cosmos, the place where everything ends up, eventually, where order and precision finally give way to the abyss. There are about 10 to the power of 80 protons, neutrons, and other similar particles scattered across our universe, still evading the abyss of black holes, still clinging on to their order and precision. This makes our universe special, like an ancient artifact that hasn't yet crumbled into dust. And when he crunched the numbers, Penrose realized that our universe must have been carved with a level of precision that just didn't make sense, an incredibly low entropy. A 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 123 chance. And this impossible number is not alone. Antimatter is like the mirror image of matter, and when the two combine, they destroy each other. And although there are 10 to the power of 80 protons, neutrons, and other matter particles in the universe, there are only a sprinkling of antiparticles. But this is just as well. If there had been an equal number of particles and antiparticles created in the Big Bang, they would have annihilated each other out of existence almost instantly. And yet there is nothing in our best models of the universe that seems to give enough of a preference for matter over antimatter. In fact, when we extrapolate the results of experiments, it looks like the universe should have been born with an equal number. Everything should have been annihilated. You and I should not exist. The universe should not exist. And yet, it does. But there is one prediction that worries physicists far more than the lack of antimatter, or the remarkably ordered state in which the universe was born. It is the weight of the universe. When theoretical physicists put quantum mechanics alongside general relativity in a controllable way, they find that the universe should have bent itself into oblivion within a moment of creation. It should have been crushed by an overwhelming weight, most of which doesn't come from the planets and stars that are sprinkled throughout the galaxy, but from empty space, the vacuum. Our entire universe should have been crushed by the weight of nothing. This is a mystery known as the cosmological constant problem, and it has haunted physicists for nearly 100 years. Julius von Mayer was a ship's doctor who served on expeditions to the Dutch East Indies in the middle of the 19th century. Whenever a sailor took ill on one of the ships, von Mayer would often resort to bloodletting. This wasn't unusual. Bloodletting was a common practice at the time, and in this case, it led von Mayer to make a groundbreaking discovery. In the hot sun of Indonesia, he noticed that the blood running through a sailor's veins was just as red as the blood running through their arteries. Back home in his native Germany, where the weather was not so warm, the blood running through the veins of his patients was always a little darker than the arterial blood. This was, he believed, because it was lacking in oxygen, which had been used in the slow combustion of food to help keep the patient warm. In Indonesia, the sailors were bathed in tropical sunshine. They didn't need to burn as much fuel to stay warm, so their veins carried blood with higher levels of oxygen and appeared much redder in color. Von Meyer realized that the heat generated from the combustion of food in the body must be equivalent to the heat absorbed from the sun. He realized that heat was just another form of energy. But what is energy? And what does this have to do with the weight of the universe, or even the cosmological constant? Energy is the most precious commodity of all. We need energy to power our vehicles, to heat our homes, to watch videos on YouTube. And as von Meyer realized, it comes in many different forms. In the 18th century, early industrialists were looking for ways to convert trapped energy into useful work that could power their machines. That is what energy is, stuff that we can convert into work. Old-fashioned water wheels store potential energy by lifting a heavy bucket of water up high before allowing it to fall, converting the energy into useful kinetic energy, the energy of motion. The steam engines of the Industrial Revolution took the chemical energy stored in coal, converted that into heat, before once again creating motion. And it was Einstein who came to realize that mass was also another form of energy. And to understand why, we need to remember the cosmic speed limit, the speed of light. Nothing can go faster than the speed of light, which is about 299,792,458 meters per second. This limit applies to everything, to the speed of a bullet or a particle whizzing around a collider. It even applies to Usain Bolt, the legendary Jamaican sprinter. Of course, despite his remarkable talent, Bolt never managed to get anywhere near the speed of light. But what if he had? What if there were a supercharged version of Usain Bolt capable of accelerating all the way up to the speed of light? How could he do this? To accelerate up to higher speeds, the supercharged Bolt would need to take on energy, presumably in the form of food. As he approached the speed of light, he would find it harder and harder to accelerate. This has to be the case. If it were not, he would be in danger of breaking the speed limit, and we know that can't happen. But what is it that stops him from accelerating? It must be that his resistance to acceleration, his inertia, is getting bigger and bigger. The energy he consumes isn't just going away, it's being converted into inertia. As he approaches the speed of light, it doesn't matter how much energy he takes on board, his inertia just grows and grows and stops him from accelerating beyond the speed limit. With a thought experiment like this, Einstein understood that inertia was just another form of energy, and that had to remain true even when Bolt wasn't running, when he was at rest. But what is Bolt's inertia when he is resting? It's just his mass. And so, mass and energy are equivalent. And Einstein captured this remarkable fact with his most famous equation, E equals mc squared. This equation tells you how much energy, E, you should associate with a certain amount of mass, m. C, in this case, is the speed of light, at around 300 million meters per second. That's quite a big conversion factor, which means just a small amount of mass is equivalent to a huge amount of energy. For example, a small dog weighing around 9 kilograms stores energy equivalent to almost a million trillion joules, or 200 megatons of TNT. That's roughly the energy that was released by the eruption of Krakatoa in 1883. Whenever nuclear fusion occurs, a small amount of mass is converted into a huge amount of heat. This happens inside a thermonuclear weapon, as isotopes of hydrogen fuse together to form heavier elements, with a net loss in the overall mass. It also happens in the core of the sun, powering the life-giving glow that keeps our planet warm. The conversion of mass into other forms of energy is one of the most powerful forces in nature. And so, when a physicist asks you how much you weigh, or how much the universe weighs, they aren't asking if you've eaten a little too much over the holidays. They are asking about the force of gravity that pulls on you, or indeed, the universe. Of course, how big it is may well depend on how much you've eaten over the holidays, because we normally think of gravity as pulling on mass, and the more mass you carry, the more you weigh. But this is only half the story. Gravity doesn't just pull on mass. Once Einstein had realized that mass and energy were equivalent, he realized that gravity should pull on any form of energy. Light, for example, doesn't have any mass, but it does have energy. And that's why gravity pulls it on a bent path around the sun. When we ask how much you weigh, or how much the universe weighs, we are really asking how much energy there is. And there is a huge amount of energy hiding in all the mass and radiation we see in the universe. It is hiding in the stars and planets that populate the galaxies. It is in the very radiation that spreads through the cosmos. But this is only a small fraction of the total energy budget. Much of the universe is made from an unknown, invisible source, the so-called dark universe. This is where it gets most of its weight. And so just like gazing at your scales after the holidays, or measuring how much flour you need for your cake, it's time for us to weigh the universe. In the city of Syracuse in the 3rd century BC, Archimedes, arguably the greatest mathematician of his time, is contemplating the size of the universe. There are some who think that the number of the sand is infinite in multitude. And I mean by the sand not only that which exists about Syracuse and the rest of Sicily, but also that which is found in every other region, inhabited or uninhabited. But Archimedes is not convinced by this infinite number of grains of sand, and sets about calculating how many could actually fit inside the universe. This is his famous sand reckoner, and it begins with a poppy seed. Laying seeds out side by side, Archimedes notes that 40 of them would make up a single Greek dactyl, a finger width equivalent to around 19 millimeters in modern units. And within each seed, he imagines a myriad grains of sand. A myriad is 10,000, the largest unit available to Archimedes at the time. To compute how many grains of sand there were in the universe, he had to invent a new system of numbers, and he also had to estimate the size of the universe. To Archimedes, the universe reached as far as a blanket of fixed stars that formed an enormous sphere centered around the sun. With a series of clever and crude approximations, he estimated the diameter of this sphere to be equivalent to 100 trillion Greek stadia, or about 2 light years to us. Bringing everything together, he triumphantly concluded that the universe would not be able to accommodate an infinite number of grains of sand. The number would not exceed 10 to the power of 63. How much would such a universe weigh? Well, Archimedes wasn't really worried about that. But if we imagine that each grain of sand weighs around 10 milligrams, then Archimedes' sand-filled universe would weigh about 10 billion trillion 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 kilograms. Oddly, that is not wildly incorrect. But it was just a fluke. Archimedes massively underestimated the size of the universe, and the reality is, it's not full of sand. The universe is big. When we ask how much it weighs, we are really asking how much energy it contains. Energy that is stored in the mass of the stars and planets and clouds of interstellar gas. Energy that is stored in radiation, or even in empty space. To figure out how much energy that is, we need to be clear what we mean by universe. We mean the observable universe. That is a large region of the universe as far as the eye can see, or indeed, anything else can see. The universe was born about 13.8 billion years ago. This might seem like a long time, but it has not been enough time for us to receive signals from the most distant corners of the cosmos. They are simply too far away. Even if they emit a light signal traveling at the maximum speed possible, that signal would still not have reached us in the lifetime of the universe. This boundary between what we can and cannot see is known as the observable universe. You might think that it must be about 13.8 billion light-years in size, since that is the distance travelled by light in the lifetime of the universe. However, this doesn't take into account the expansion of space. When this is considered, it turns out we could have received signals from objects that are up to 46.5 billion light-years away. And so that is the size of the observable universe. About 93 billion light-years in diameter. Of course, the universe doesn't actually stop at this point. There isn't a giant cosmic wall at 46.5 billion light-years. But we have no way of knowing what it's really like beyond this point. It could be that the universe goes on forever, stretching all the way to infinity. Or perhaps it eventually comes back on itself, like a magnificent cosmic sphere, reaching far beyond the observable realm. This giant sphere would bend the shape of space a little. Light travelling vast distances towards us could be sensitive to that bendiness, and we could hope to detect it. But so far, we've detected nothing. If the universe really is shaped like a sphere, it would have to be undetectably large, with a diameter of at least 23 trillion light-years. But whatever the size and shape of the universe, there is no way we could try and weigh the unobservable realms, because we have no way of knowing what they contain. They could be filled with grains of sand, or they could be empty, void of any stars and planets. The laws of physics might even be different there. We just don't know, and we can never know. So if we really want to be serious about weighing the universe, we need to stick to the observable part, stretching 46.5 billion light-years in every direction, and weigh that. Let's start with the stars. The Sun is fairly typical, with a mass of order 2 million trillion trillion kilograms. Observations suggest that there are between 100 and 400 billion stars in our galaxy, which combine to weigh up to a billion billion trillion trillion kilograms. There are at least 200 billion galaxies in the observable universe, each containing an average of 100 billion stars. That suggests that there are at least 20 billion trillion stars altogether, weighing a grand total of around 20,000 trillion 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 kilograms. And that's actually not a bad estimate for the stuff we can actually see. But the problem is, it neglects the mass of other sources, stuff like interstellar gas. A better way to measure the mass or energy of the universe is to study its effect on the shape of space-time. One way to do this is to study the cosmic microwave background radiation, the so-called CMB. These are primordial photons left over from the moment the first atoms were formed. These photons have travelled large distances across the entire universe, from every different direction and throughout most of cosmic history. They could even be detected amongst the static in the old days of analog TV. Using state-of-the-art satellite telescopes, astronomers measure the temperature of the cosmic microwave background radiation in different parts of the sky. By measuring the statistical correlations in the temperature fluctuations in the CMB, and understanding how matter, radiation, and other forms of energy affect the shape of space and time, astronomers are able to figure out what the universe is made of. And the cosmic microwave background, in combination with other methods and probes, reveals that the observable universe has around 150,000 trillion, 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 trillion kilograms of mass stored in the stuff we can see. Stars, planets, clouds of interstellar gas, and even the human race. That's about 7.5 times our previous estimate. It sounds like a lot, but the stuff we can see is only 5% of the energy out there. There are two more ingredients, and they dominate the universe. First, there is dark matter. This is just like ordinary matter that makes up atoms or humans or stars or planets, except it's completely invisible. If you shine a torch on it, the light will just pass through. If you try to whack it with a baseball bat, it would be as if you were just swinging the bat in empty space. We have no way of touching or feeling dark matter, except through gravity. It carries mass and energy just like ordinary matter, and so we can feel its effect on space-time. But although dark matter is 5 times more abundant than visible matter, it's still not the dominant ingredient in our universe. That is dark energy. Dark energy makes up a whopping 70% of the universe, another invisible substance. It is responsible for pushing the universe apart, causing the cosmic expansion to quicken over time. We see this through the light from distant supernova. These explosions are reasonably well understood, and yet the more distant ones are dimmer than expected. This dimming is easily accounted for by the accelerated expansion of space, by the push of dark energy. So just what is dark energy? All the data points towards an exotic substance whose energy density is more or less constant right across the universe. And as we will come to understand, this is just what you'd expect from the energy of empty space. Empty space, it turns out, is not empty. It is really a bubbling broth of virtual particles that can never be tamed, that are forever popping in and out of existence, weighing the universe down, giving it energy, giving it weight. This energy of empty space goes by many names. In the early days of quantum mechanics, most people called it the Nullpunktsenergie, which is German for zero-point energy. Nowadays, people often call it the vacuum energy, or sometimes the cosmological constant. They all mean the same thing, and they are what most scientists associate with dark energy. Our observable universe contains dark energy equivalent to around 46 trillion 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 tons of TNT. And when you put everything together, the planets, the stars, the dark matter, the dark energy, you find a universe containing energy equivalent to 67 trillion 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 tons of TNT. And that is how much the universe weighs. This might seem like a lot, but remember, all this energy is spread evenly across a large universe. The density is very low. Dark energy is so dilute that a coffee cup full of it doesn't contain enough energy to crush a fairy fly, the smallest insect in the world. And that's just as well, as this low density is what allowed the universe to grow large and old. But in weighing the universe, we now run into one of the greatest of all the cosmological puzzles. The cosmological constant problem. If you really want to think about dark energy as the energy of empty space, then why is there so little of it? For when we take our most tried and trusted theories of physics at face value, we find that the Nullpunktsenergie should be absolutely enormous. Our universe should not be the gently evolving cosmos we see today. It should have been born a super heavyweight, instantly crushed under the weight of its vacuum, bent into oblivion in time and space, torn to shreds by the tides of gravity, and gone within the blink of an eye. Our universe should never have grown large and old. It should never have allowed intelligent life to evolve. It should never have allowed you to exist. But our universe did grow large and old. It did allow you to exist. Indeed, the truth is, the universe is not a heavyweight. It's not even a flyweight. So the question is, why is there so little dark energy? Where is all the Nullpunktsenergie? Why hasn't it destroyed the universe? To understand the Nullpunktsenergie and the puzzle it creates, we have to travel back 100 years to the German city of Hamburg, to a cafe overlooking the banks of the Inner Alster. Hamburg is a vibrant city, risen from the ashes of World War I, a bustling metropolis and a centre of intellectual thought. And in the cafe are two physicists, two friends. Otto Stern is a bon vivant. He enjoys the finer things in life. Good food, good wine, good company. He sometimes takes a flight to Vienna just to have lunch. Wolfgang Pauli, however, is a very different character. He is currently sporting a black eye, sustained the night before in the bars of the Reeperbahn, in Hamburg's notorious St. Pauli district. Pauli had been brawling, as he often did, fueled by alcohol and a fiery personality. Stern takes a sip of his brandy and turns to his old friend. I'm telling you, Wolfgang, the Nullpunktsenergie is real. I've calculated its effects on the vapor pressure of the isotopes of neon. If it were absent, as you say it should be, the difference in the vapor pressure of neon 20 and neon 22 would be enormous. But Pauli isn't convinced. He begins scribbling down a calculation on a napkin. When he's done, he looks up triumphantly. But what of gravity, Otto? If the Nullpunktsenergie were real, as you say it should be, the universe would not even reach the moon. The Nullpunktsenergie is the energy of empty space. The energy of the vacuum. Consider the universe around you. It is filled with stars that shine their light throughout the cosmos, from the menace of red giants to the sickly glow of white dwarfs. There are hostile planets in orbit around these stars, giant and minnow, too hot and too cold. There are the warm and welcoming planets like the Earth, jewels in the solar system where life can prosper. There are towering clouds of gas, monuments of coloured nebulae, where stars are being born. And all of this stuff carries mass. It carries energy. But suppose a cosmic bailiff were to enter the universe and take it all away. They take away every star, every planet, every human, and all other forms of complex life. They take away the nebulae, the black holes, the bacteria and dust. They take everything. Alive and dead, large and small. What would be left? A dark and silent place of true desolation. The most empty of empty space. Naively, you might expect this emptiness to be weightless, to be free of all energy, having been robbed of its wares by the cosmic bailiff. But that is not true. At least, we don't think it's true. Quantum theory has taught us that empty space does carry energy. It carries the Nullpunktsenergie, the zero-point energy, the vacuum energy, the cosmological constant. The celebrated German physicist and father of quantum mechanics, Max Planck, had toyed with the idea of the Nullpunktsenergie as early as 1911, and soon after, it was another German, Walter Nernst, who suggested that the vacuum of empty space was not empty, but an exotic medium filled with an enormous amount of energy. But perhaps the most celebrated German physicist of the time, Albert Einstein, had a turbulent relationship with the Nullpunktsenergie, and also, separately, the idea of a cosmological constant. At first, he was a champion of both. Indeed, it was he who came up with the idea of a cosmological constant in 1917, requiring a repulsive force present throughout all of space to counter the effect of gravity in what he believed at the time was a static universe. He'd also separately teamed up with Otto Stern and computed the effects of the Nullpunktsenergie on hydrogen molecules, their results matching experimental data. But he did not connect the two, and within a decade, Einstein had switched camps on both the cosmological constant and the Nullpunktsenergie, supposedly calling the constant his biggest blunder and stating that no theoretician can utter the word zero-point energy without breaking into a half-embarrassed, half-ironic smile. But it would turn out that Einstein was right in his invoking of a cosmological constant, and wrong in his dismissal of the Nullpunktsenergie, and the idea of zero-point energy really took hold in the mid-1920s. For this was when the legendary German physicist Werner Heisenberg entered the game. Struck down by severe hay fever in the summer of 1925, Heisenberg had fled to the island of Helgoland, where he checked into a guest house overlooking the dunes. His allergies were so bad that the lady who ran the guest house assumed he'd been in a fight. Heisenberg used his escape to think deeply about the spectral lines of the hydrogen atom, thoughts that often led to insomnia. And indeed, it was in the early hours of one particular night that a breakthrough finally came, and Heisenberg finally began to understand how the hydrogen atom behaved. He was beginning to understand the sorcerer's world of quantum mechanics, where everything was a game of chance. and as Heisenberg realized, it was a game that led to the zero-point energy, the Nullpunkt Zenergy. To understand how the zero-point energy emerges, go to the kitchen and take out a large mixing bowl. Throw a marble into the bowl and wait for it to settle down. Eventually, it'll seem as if it's at rest at the bottom of the bowl. But is that really true? Can we really say exactly where it is and how fast it is moving? If you zoom into the micro world, the answer is clearly no. There are air particles constantly colliding with the marble, knocking it to and fro. Okay, but what if you suck out all the air in the room and cool it down to absolute zero? What then? Does the marble finally come to rest at the bottom of the bowl? Or does it wiggle? It wiggles. Heisenberg realized that there was always some uncertainty. A key thing to remember is that quantum mechanics is a game of chance. You can only deal with probabilities. It turns out that the more you know about a particle's position, the less you know about its momentum. So if we know where a particle is, we cannot say how fast it is moving, and vice versa. This means that if we scale the marble down to the size of a fundamental particle, we can never say if it is exactly at rest at the bottom of the bowl, as that would mean we had exact knowledge of both its position and its momentum. Heisenberg's understanding of uncertainty and the laws of quantum mechanics mean that it's simply not possible to know both exactly. In the microscopic world, something always has to wiggle. And so now we can return to our cosmic bailiff, determined to empty the universe of all its stars, planets, and little green men. Before he arrives, the universe is littered with particles, electrons and photons, quarks and gluons, gauge bosons and Higgs bosons, and perhaps even some particles we still don't know about. These particles are, in actual fact, just ripples in the fundamental fields of nature. The photon is a ripple in the electromagnetic field, the electron a ripple in the electron field, the Higgs boson a ripple in the Higgs field. You can imagine these fields as an ocean swell, and the particles as the ripples on top. What the bailiff is really trying to do is get rid of all the ripples, all the excitations of these fundamental fields. He is trying to silence the ocean of reality, to make it perfectly flat. But, as we know, he can't. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle means he can never silence the ocean completely. There is always that quantum wiggle. Tiny, short-lived ripples in the fundamental fields. But these remaining ripples don't correspond to real particles, like electrons or photons you can touch and perhaps even hang on to. If they were real, if you could hang on to them, the bailiff would just grab them and take them away. Instead, they are something more mysterious. They are virtual particles. These virtual particles are forever popping in and out of existence, like a bubbling broth in the vacuum of empty space. They're not the kind of particles you can hang on to, but they do give the vacuum its energy. They give it the Nullpunktsenergy. But is this energy actually real? Or was it just a figment of Heisenberg's imagination? There is a fascinating macroscopic example that helps to answer this question. The gecko. As it scampers freely across walls and ceilings, its seemingly magical ability to defy gravity is thought to have its roots in the Nullpunktsenergy. It turns out that the energy stored in a vacuum through the bubbling broth of virtual particles depends crucially on the shape of its surroundings. Change the shape and you can change the energy. That means that the vacuum will push and pull on the walls that surround it as it tries to lower its energy. This push and pull of the vacuum is a force known as the Casimir force, named after the Dutch physicist Hendrik Casimir. When the walls of the vacuum are far apart, this Casimir force is tiny. But when they're close together, this force is big enough to measure. Changes in the zero-point energy also lead to van der Waals forces between atoms and molecules. And this is what some biologists think is responsible for the gecko's ability to walk on walls. Microscopic projections on the soles of their feet surround small pockets of vacuum, and by altering the shape, the gecko creates a force strong enough to defy gravity. And so now that we've accepted that the vacuum energy is real, we can estimate how big we think it should be. How much energy would you expect to find in a coffee cup of empty space? To figure this out, we need to break space up into lots of little pieces, like a spectacular cosmic jigsaw. The size of the pieces is going to affect our estimate, so we should think about what size we should use. You might think the pieces should be as small as the eye can see. That would make them little boxes about a millimeter across. But why would we allow ourselves to be held back by the limitations of a human eye? When Pauli was doing his calculation in the cafe in Hamburg, he imagined jigsaw pieces with sides about a trillion times smaller, at around a femtometer. This corresponds to the classical electron radius, which was at the limit of experimental physics at the time. And this is where Heisenberg comes in with his uncertainty. If you can resolve the universe into jigsaw pieces just a femtometer across, you can have extremely precise knowledge about where and when a virtual particle pops in and out of existence. Heisenberg says that must come at a price. You must lose knowledge of the momentum of the particle. This means you must also lose knowledge of its energy. As you make the jigsaw pieces smaller and smaller, the virtual particles can reach higher and higher energies. For jigsaw pieces like Pauli's, about a femtometer across, these energies reach up to a few trillionths of a joule for each of our little boxes. That doesn't seem like much, but remember, the boxes are tiny, so the density is dangerously high. For a coffee cup of empty space, with lots and lots of these tiny little boxes, the total energy stored inside the cup comes out at a whopping 100,000 trillion trillion joules. That's enough energy to boil away all the oceans of the Earth. But why stop there? It's been almost a century since Pauli performed his calculation in the cafe in Hamburg. Since then, physics has moved on. We've developed technology that has enabled us to probe deeper and deeper into the microscopic fabric of the universe. In the tunnels beneath the mountains on the Swiss-French border lies the Large Hadron Collider, CERN's state-of-the-art particle accelerator, a machine that recreates the first moments of the universe, colliding subatomic particles head-on at almost the speed of light. These collisions allow physicists to peer deep into the microworld with unprecedented resolution, breaking the universe up into pieces that are 10 to the minus 19 meters across. That is 10,000 times smaller than an electron, 10,000 times smaller than the jigsaw pieces Pauli had imagined. When you break down the universe into pieces this small, you can resolve virtual particles popping in and out of existence every billionth of a nanosecond, filling the vacuum with enormous amounts of ambient quantum energy. With this estimate, a coffee cup of empty space would have enough energy to blow up an entire planet. And not just once, more than 100 million times, wiping out every planet in the galaxy. But again, why stop there? The collisions in the tunnel at CERN are at the edge of experimental physics, as it is today. But that is only limited by our technology, and of course, funding. There's no real reason to believe that physics cannot go beyond this point. With better machines, we could imagine peering even more deeply into the microworld, resolving the universe on an even smaller scale. So how far could we go? Well, we could imagine breaking the universe up into pieces as small as the Planck length, which is more than a million billion times smaller than the scale of our experiments at CERN. The Planck length is the distance at which the fabric of space and time ceases to make sense, as it becomes overwhelmed by quantum effects. If we tried to break the universe up into pieces smaller than the Planck length, the very notion of space and time would begin to disintegrate. But tiny little boxes of Planckian size are more than enough to worry about. If we break the universe up into pieces this small, we find that our coffee cup of empty space would contain a Google gigajoules of energy. And that is enough to blow up every planet and star in the observable universe again and again and again, more than a trillion, 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 trillion times. So, Should we be worried? Should it terrify us to learn that empty space must contain such gargantuan energies, lurking all around us, between the molecules of air, even in the empty space between the atoms in your body? In a world without gravity, there's nothing to fear. For this Nullpunktsenergy is constant. The energy density of empty space is the same everywhere. That's why we sometimes call it the cosmological constant. To create weapons that destroy planets and galaxies, you need energy differences, gradients in the energy density that allow you to generate a force. The true underlying vacuum energy of our entire universe has constant density across all of space. There are no gradients. You couldn't use it to crush a grape, never mind a galaxy. Without gravity, this vacuum energy cannot touch you. But with gravity, that's a very different story. With gravity, the vacuum energy goes wild. To understand this, we need to understand how gravity works. Einstein taught us that the gravitational force is very different to the other fundamental forces in nature. In some senses, it's not really a force at all. Gravity is really the shape of space-time. And so it isn't just mass that bends space and time. Mass is just a form of energy. All energy bends the space and time around it, creating the warped shapes in space-time that we perceive as gravity. The Nullpunktsenergy is no exception. The vacuum energy, the cosmological constant, whatever you want to call it, will bend the shape of space and time, even if it is the same everywhere. And of course, the more of this energy you have, the more space-time should be bent. This is why Pauli declared that the universe would not even reach the moon. He calculated the density of the energy in empty space and worked out how much that would bend space-time, quickly seeing that space-time would be bent right back, so that the observable realm could not even reach as far as the moon. But we've already seen how Pauli had underestimated the vacuum energy, guided as he was by the limits of experimental physics in his day. Modern estimates suggest that the universe would contain so much energy in empty space, it would be bent into oblivion, crushed under its own weight. It wouldn't even reach beyond the end of your nose, never mind the moon. And now, we have to state the obvious. The universe does reach beyond the end of your nose. In fact, it reaches a billion trillion times farther than the moon. The edge of the observable universe, as we've seen, is around 46.5 billion light-years away. If the cosmological constant is there, it's a whole lot smaller than we expected. In fact, it should be more than a Google times smaller. The energy stored in a coffee cup of empty space cannot be enough to destroy a planet or star. It shouldn't even be enough to crush the smallest insect in the world. This is the cosmological constant problem. Our best and most trusted theories of fundamental physics come together to predict that our universe should be so overwhelmed by the Nullpunktsenergy, by a terrifyingly large cosmological constant, that it simply shouldn't exist. And yet, it does. Why? On the 3rd of September 1949, a filter paper on a weather plane flying from Japan to Alaska detected unusually high levels of radioactivity. The filter paper was sent to the US scientific lab at Los Alamos for further analysis. And on the 23rd of September, US President Harry S. Truman announced that the Soviet Union had successfully detonated an atomic device. The bomb had been detonated a few days prior to the flight of the weather plane, at 7 a.m. local time on August the 29th, at the Semipalatinsk test site in modern-day Kazakhstan. 10 kilometers south of Ground Zero were 8 men, amongst them Yakov Zeldovich, head of the theory division at the Soviet Nuclear Development Center at Arzamas 16. Zeldovich remembered seeing a bright cone-shaped flash with a tongue of fire coming out of the dust and smoke before stepping down into the safety trench. After 30 seconds, the sound of the explosion reached the trench like a clap of thunder. Some of the men celebrated in praise of Comrade Stalin. Zeldovich stayed silent. To the Soviets, Zeldovich was a silent superstar, a legendary physicist who played a pivotal role in their nuclear weapons program, and one of only 16 people to have been named a hero of socialist labor on three separate occasions. Whereas Robert Oppenheimer became less active in physics after his involvement in developing the nuclear bomb, Zeldovich went on to make major contributions to particle physics, astronomy, and cosmology. And it was Zeldovich, 20 years later in 1967 and 1968, who made the world take notice of the cosmological constant problem. It's not clear if Zeldovich knew about Pauli and his enigmatic calculation in the cafe in Hamburg in the mid-1920s, but it didn't matter. Zeldovich was armed with far more powerful tools than Pauli ever had at his disposal. By the late 60s, the general theory of relativity was well established, along with its applications to cosmology. Quantum field theory was fast becoming the dominant description for a subatomic world. It was really Zeldovich who saw that the vacuum ought to be a bubbling broth of virtual particles, endlessly popping in and out of existence, weighing down the vacuum, bending the universe back into oblivion. Zeldovich knew that something had to be wrong with our understanding of the universe, and sensed an opportunity for physics, stating that the clarification of the cosmological constant will be of tremendous fundamental significance for the theory of elementary particles. So what can we do about this cosmological constant problem? Perhaps we should just take an empirical approach. The energy of empty space is whatever we measure it to be. If it's small, it's small. Who cares about Zeldovich and the predictions of quantum field theory? Who cares about Pauli and his idiosyncratic cafe calculations? Perhaps that's just not how nature chose to do things. But this is not very satisfying. The quest is to discover how the universe works, and a wealth of empirical data points towards a microworld accurately described by quantum field theory, the relativistic version of quantum mechanics developed in the years following the Second World War. We can't just simply abandon it, not after so much experimental success elsewhere. And then there is the general theory of relativity, the zenith of Einstein's genius, describing gravity as the shape of space-time, accurately predicting exotic phenomena like the bending of light around the sun and the perihelion precession of the planet Mercury, a slow but relentless shift in its elliptical orbit. It too has a huge wealth of data supporting it, even being added to this day, LIGO's detection of gravitational waves in 2015, another feather in its cap. But together, these two great pillars of 20th century physics predict a universe instantly destroyed by the overwhelming weight of the vacuum, by a Herculean cosmological constant, by the Nullpunktsenergie. As Zeldovich realized more than 50 years ago, we are obviously misunderstanding something. Something very important. The cosmological constant problem is such a crisis in our understanding of fundamental physics. Its resolution is expected to lead to something profound, a step change in our picture of how the universe really works. Another example of something similar is the famous black hole information paradox, another problem that Zeldovich had a hand in. This is the question of what happens to all the information you throw into a black hole. Does it disappear in violation of the laws of quantum mechanics, or does it survive? And if so, where does it go? Just like the solution to the cosmological constant problem, the answers to these questions are expected to reveal something deep about the fundamental fabric of our physical world. And so theoretical physicists are forever looking for the solution to the cosmological constant problem. In the half century since Zeldovich formulated the problem in modern terms, many solutions have come, but many have also gone. A common thread is assuming that Zeldovich's calculation of the cosmological constant is only part of the story, that the elementary particles contribute an overwhelmingly large vacuum energy, but that there is another piece, another constant from some hitherto hidden sector of the microworld, that cancels out the parts that Zeldovich found. How and why it would be able to cancel them out to such an astonishing level of precision is the key piece of the puzzle. It's like balancing the weight of a trillion, 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 trillion suns, accurate to the mass of a single electron. The most popular idea makes use of the multiverse, the idea that our observable universe is just one of many possible universes, each with a different value for the overall cosmological constant, and perhaps other fundamental constants. In most parts of this theoretical multiverse, the scales are off balance, and the overall cosmological constant is large and overwhelming. But in some rare corners of the multiverse, the balancing works, and the overall cosmological constant is small, just like it is in our universe. String theory, our most promising candidate for a theory of everything, predicts that such a multiverse could exist. It has all the right sort of hidden sectors with a multitude of different possibilities. Depending on who you ask, string theory predicts between 10 to the power of 500 and 10 to the power of 272,000 different vacua, different universes with a range of vacuum energies, a spectrum of cosmological constants. This multiverse is known as the string theory landscape, and it's just what we would need to take on the cosmological constant problem with an innovative but controversial idea. But if small cosmological constants are rare in this possible multiverse, how come we find ourselves in a universe with a tiny cosmological constant? This is where some physicists advocate the anthropic principle. The idea is that those universes with a large and overwhelming cosmological constant are uninhabitable because of the enormous weight of empty space. If the cosmological constant is too large and positive, the universe is blasted apart too quickly, so much so that matter is unable to clump together and stars and planets never get the chance to form. If the cosmological constant is too large and negative, the expansion of the universe rapidly gives way to an apocalyptic crunch, a universe squashed out of existence, again before stars and planets ever get to form. It is only in these rare universes, like ours, where the cosmological constant is unexpectedly small, that conditions are just right. A Goldilocks universe, with a slow and gentle cosmic evolution, allowing time for stars and planets to form, and providing a home for complex life. Indeed, it is only in these Goldilocks worlds that someone, or something, like Pauli or Zeldovich, can eventually be born, smart enough to ask difficult questions about the cosmological constant, about the energy of empty space. But not everyone likes this explanation. Some people say that the multiverse and anthropic selection is unscientific, that it cannot be falsified. Although, that is not entirely true. Back in 1997, Nobel laureate Steven Weinberg and his collaborators argued that if the vacuum energy was less than 60% of the total energy budget of the universe, anthropic arguments could not explain why it was so small. This was a testable prediction of the anthropic solution to the cosmological constant problem. And as it happened, less than a year later, astronomers announced the discovery of dark energy, making up around 70% of all the energy in the observable universe. The anthropic principle had passed its first test. But people are still searching for alternative ideas that don't rely on anthropic reasoning. These ideas go by many names: supersymmetric large extra dimensions, vacuum energy sequestering, pancosmic relativity, to name but a few. However, there is no consensus, and right now, the mystery of the cosmological constant remains unsolved. And so, we set out to weigh the universe and stumbled across one of the most embarrassing problems in fundamental physics. We weighed the stars and the planets and clouds of interstellar gas. We weighed the halos of dark matter that shroud our galaxies. And we weighed the vacuum of empty space. And it weighed so little. Where was the weight of the bubbling broth of virtual particles frantically popping in and out of existence? It should have crushed the universe within an instant of creation. But it didn't. Our universe is light, a gentle giant that allowed you and I to live on a rocky planet orbiting an ordinary yellow star somewhere in a galaxy called the Milky Way. You've been watching the entire history of the universe. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave us a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.